Hello, everybody. Welcome into the inaugural episode of the Lakers Collective. I'm Trevor Lane. Happy to be here. Get this off the ground. Joined by Jason Timpf, Jovan Buha. Guys, this is awesome. First episode. Happy to have you all here and talk some Lakers.
Yeah, dude, I couldn't be more excited. I've always enjoyed talking hoops with you guys individually. Now we're going to do it together, and I kind of love this format. Like, it's just such a cool way for us to do a little State of the Lakers, kind of pop in once a week and just kind of see where the team is at. Less on like a individual game reaction basis, although today we have one game to react to, but more on like a, how are things progressing, like weekly check-ins. I think we all provide some unique perspective. I think it's going to be a fun little endeavor that we're starting here.
Excited to be here with you guys. I've done a few audience surveys, and the two most requested guests for my show have been you two. And the most feedback I've gotten on episodes has been with you two. So thrilled to be here with you both.
With our powers combined here. So that's right. We're gonna try to be here every Thursday, 10 a.m. Pacific time. There may be some changes and things like that. But those of you jumping in, joining us live, we're happy to have you here. We're going to try to be here each week to talk some Lakers basketball with you. And I guess, you know, we've got at least one game to analyze, to pull from. Jason, let's start with you. What are some early takeaways or some of your big takeaways from that Lakers game against the Warriors? Specifically, we look at moving forward into a tough matchup tomorrow night against the Wolves.
Yeah, you know, this typically happens because I definitely have a little bit of an emotional fan in me. But the night of when I was watching, I was incredibly frustrated. I thought that they juxtaposed with the other three elite teams that we watched that night. I thought the gap in like physical intensity was tangible. And it's part of it has to do with the fact that we know this Lakers roster doesn't have a lot of athleticism. But even then, just in like overall just competitive fire and intensity, even above and beyond any sort of athletic limitations, I thought the Lakers just looked like a completely different class of team in a bad way than the other two teams. And they were incredibly sloppy in their transition defense. They were botching switches all over the floor and giving up back cuts. And on offense, they seemed to be a little bit clunky with their spacing and their processing out of double teams and traps. And they just looked like a team that was way behind schedule. And I was really frustrated. But then when I rewatched the game, I felt a little bit more optimistic. I still see the same limitations, but that game really got off the rails in the early third quarter, as we know. And when I rewatched it, I don't have a problem with the way that Ayton was guarding Kuminga on those first few actions. He was sinking into the paint to help on cuts from Steph, and Kuminga hit some late contest threes. And that's going to be the game plan when you're guarding Golden State. You're going to want to offer help on drives and cuts from their more polished offensive players. And you want to, we've been doing this for years with them. Make Kuminga make threes, make Draymond make threes. Even the pivotal possession late, Rui Hachimura, after we went up six, Rui Hachimura sunk in the lane to help, and Draymond Green hit a three. Credit to the Warriors there. And on the other end of the floor, Luka missed some free throws on some and ones. Rui Hachimura got two wide open looks on threes that didn't go down. Austin Reeves, who had been deadly in the mid-range all night, missed a pretty easy one right around the left elbow. There were a lot of shots where it's like you could see a version of that game where like Kuminga misses those threes, Luka makes those free throws, Rui hits his threes, and suddenly the Lakers are up seven or eight, and the entire vibe of the game is different. That doesn't take away the fact that there are obvious limitations. We saw Gabe Vincent in the starting lineup getting attacked. We're going to talk about that, I'm sure, today. Mm-hmm. There are certainly some issues with Ayton in the middle of the floor scoring and processing. There's definitely things that are issues, but I came away from the rewatch a little less annoyed than I was the night of when I was reacting emotionally as a fan.
Well, I agree that there's always going to be an emotional reaction to the end result, and that's what we can tend to focus on. Did the shot go in or not? Did you win the game or not? And that oftentimes will inform us of whether or not what we saw was a good thing or a bad thing. If you win by one, it was a good game. If you lose by one, it was a bad game. But and that's typically the fandom that comes out. But Jovan, from a process perspective, what did you see from the Lakers against the Warriors? Did the result was not a positive one, but process-wise, were you happy with what you saw?
I agree and echo what Jason just said, where I thought I've now rewatched the game like one and a half times, and in rewatching it, I felt like the process was better than it felt in the moment. And I think to your guys' points here, like, they had a lot of glaring mistakes where, you know, Austin is misreading a roll from Ayton and just throwing the ball into two Warriors players, and they're getting back cut left and right, and no one is within like 8 feet of a Warriors player for a dunk or a layup, and stuff like that, where that stuff, like, it tends to stick in your mind a little bit more than the mundane possession where everyone kind of does the right thing and then the Warriors just hit a tough shot or something like that, right? So I think they did make a lot of just egregious errors that they need to clean up. And I think that was the emphasis at practice yesterday going through the film, was they were like, there's like so many self-inflicted wounds. Now, my counterpoint to that would be a lot of this could have been ironed out in the preseason with more practice time and more games together in the preseason. And Rui mentioned that this was their second game together as a group. And it's like, part of that was its own self-inflicted wound of them choosing to operate like, you know, in this manner. But I think the offense, like, there's a lot of low hanging fruit with it of like Luka and Austin looked great in terms of getting into the paint, and they combined to shoot 18 of 20 in the paint. Luka was 13 of 14. Austin was 5 of 6. So that was an issue last year of paint touches and putting pressure on the rim and just penetrating the teeth of the defense. So I thought that was a positive development and something that hopefully they can do more moving forward. And even defensively, for as bad as it looked in the preseason and as bad as it was for some individual possessions, I thought a lot of guys largely did what they needed to do. I think there needs to be some tweaks with the starting group. I think there needs to be some tweaks with some of the bench rotations in terms of just putting some different players out there and setting up some guys to succeed more. But overall, like, I see the outline of what this team can be. They just need, honestly, a lot more practice time and reps. And the unfortunate thing is the schedule is unforgiving, and you just get thrown into the fire with Minnesota on Friday.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, JJ mentioned that he actually liked that the Warriors were the first opponent. I thought going into the game that, man, you can't ask for a worse opponent than the Warriors, a team that is going to pick apart any little mistake that you make out there on the floor. And they have that continuity and cohesiveness that the Lakers don't. JJ said he wanted that stuff, you know, exposed so that they could work on those things and fix those things. You mentioned the starting lineup. Jason, the starting lineup was a topic of conversation going in. In hindsight, did JJ Redick make a mistake going with Gabe Vincent in the starting five? And if so, what should he do about it?
So I was less worked up about it. Gabe's not who I would have started. I would have started Jared Vanderbilt. But I kind of look at it as there was no clear option. It wasn't like there was a dude in camp who had, quote unquote, earned the spot. As a matter of fact, if you wanted to go off of the quality of play, who played best in camp, Gabe, Vando, Jake LaRavia, Marcus Smart, I'd argue Gabe played better than everybody in camp. And so it obviously came with some limitations. So for instance, like, let's say you have Jared Vanderbilt out there instead of Gabe. Is he going to get targeted as often by Jimmy Butler the way that Gabe Vincent was? Obviously not. But the flip side is, via staggering, Gabe would have ended up out there anyway. And in the minutes he was out there, he would have been targeted by Jimmy anyway. So it's not like that was something that was going to be unique to the starting lineup as a problem. And, you know, the way I looked at it is, I went down the line. Each guy kind of presented some obvious upsides and some obvious downsides. Like, Jared Vanderbilt obviously changes the athletic profile of the lineup. He adds a rebounding element and can guard the opposing best player probably better than anybody on the roster, right? So that's an upside. But the downside is, like, for all of the optimism surrounding Jared offensively in camp, like, oh, the jump shot looks better, he's putting the ball on the floor, where every time he took a jump shot, it looked awful. And every time that he put the ball on the floor, it looked awful in that game. And so, like, there's obviously a huge offensive downside that comes with that. Marcus Smart has shown a lot of, like, kind of gimmicky defensive playmaking with just kind of his savvy and his flopping and a lot of that kind of stuff, where he made some plays on defense. And I've been generally impressed by his more refined offensive skill, like putting the ball on the floor and hitting shots in the mid-range. He's got a nice soft touch on his floater. He hits him off the dribble jump shots in preseason as well. But I haven't liked what he's looked like overall athletically on the ball. I think he's looked overmatched from a speed standpoint. Hopefully that changes as the weeks go by. But, you know, because those injuries, they tend to take a little while for you to get your legs underneath you. But I don't think he looks ready for that yet. Jake LaRavia has looked slow and has not brought enough offensively. to be like some obvious offensive option at that position. And then you have Gabe, who literally was like shooting the lights out all preseason, both in featured roles and in off-ball roles. Like, yeah, he shot the lights out against Dallas, but then he also, in an off-ball role against Sacramento, hit a bunch of shots playing off of the attention from the stars. And so I looked at Gabe as like a guy who could guard the opposing best player, who could obviously dribble, shoot, and pass well enough to kind of grease the wheels with that unit. He just clearly gave up a size and physicality element. And the Warriors attacked it. And there's a couple things, too, where you go like, maybe they offer a little bit more help and crowd Jimmy more on some of those ISOs, and it looks a little better. I thought that Jimmy got a BS foul call in the early third quarter where he drove against Gabe on the left side, and Gabe slid with him, took contact in the chest, and Jimmy just threw a shot up. Like, I don't really blame Gabe for that. I thought it was a bad call. So, like, to Gabe's point after the game, when he was talking about how he was getting attacked and how that's actually good for the defense, he's technically right if he wins, like, one or two more of those battles. You win one or two more of those battles. There was one where, like, Jimmy missed a shot against him, but they got an offensive rebound. You win a couple more of those battles, suddenly it's correct. You are stagnating the opponent. You are getting the Warriors out of their flow. They're playing one-on-one instead of playing their motion offense. And so it's more just, like, another example of playing the results, in my opinion. Jimmy hit a couple tough shots. He got a couple calls. And there was an upside to having Gabe out there compared to someone like Vando, if that makes sense.
Jovan, I need to get your take on the starting lineup, because you and I have been in agreement. I don't know if, Jason, you were pro Marcus Smart starting before we got to game one or not. I know Jovan was. I was as well. But I got to ask, before we get to that, this comment came in: the Godfather, the Kingpin, and the Mastermind. We are spoiled. Are those our nicknames? Is that us?
Which one is which?
So this has been going on my show. Trevor is the Godfather. I am the Kingpin, okay. And Jason is the Mastermind.
That's hilarious. I love it.
So, yeah, right. We got to get those graphics under. That's we'll get us right here. I agree with basically everything Jason said. I think from a philosophical perspective, the one thing I'll note is I think this is like a larger discussion with the Lakers defensive strategy, where I guess I'm kind of against their passivity with their switching. And even looking at the Gabe versus Steph, like, there were plenty of possessions where Gabe was matched up with Steph. And I would also argue that I didn't think he did a particularly good job. He got back cut three times, a couple times lost him around, you know, navigating multiple screens, which is going to happen with Steph because he's so quick and the gravity, and like, the Lakers could have handled that better. And you could also argue like there should have been help scenarios where if Gabe got back cut, there was some help. But with, especially in the second half, they just started, it would be Steph would bring the ball up. There'd be some type of screening action to get Luka or someone else switched onto Steph. Then Gabe would be on Jimmy or Kuminga or whoever. And it would either be some type of off ball action to leverage Steph's speed against a slower defender, or they would find whoever Gabe was guarding and try to create a mismatch there, often with Jimmy. So I think if they're fighting through the screens and trying to keep it with the original matchups a little bit more frequently, I kind of get it more. But if you're going to be switching everything and continuing to do this 1-4, the second there's any contact or motion, we're just switching it. I think that's where Marcus Smart and Jared Vanderbilt make far more sense because of their defensive versatility and their ability to scale up onto bigger players. So, like, despite on paper they're not being the biggest difference between Marcus Smart and Gabe Vincent, I would much rather have a Marcus Smart on a Jimmy Butler, on a Jonathan Kuminga, or looking ahead against like a Julius Randle, because if they're going to keep Gabe in the starting lineup and they're going to continue to defend this way, If I'm Minnesota, I'm looking at that and I'm finding ways to get Julius Randle matched up with Gabe Vincent, right? And I feel like the Lakers have been too passive with that, and then also not aggressive enough with their help in those scenarios. And I think, like, to Jason's point, there is something to getting a team out of its offensive flow and really trying to hammer mismatches and iso ball. But I feel like the Lakers actually lose those matchups more often than not. And they keep being like, well, we're going to, you know, the process is right, but the results aren't there. And it's like, well, at some point you have to look at the results. And I feel like they continually get, like, this happened a lot in the Minnesota series. This happened a lot in some matchups last season. The most famous one for me that I've referenced a bunch is like the KD one early in the season last year, where the Phoenix had a big comeback and the fourth quarter was just spamming, where's Gabe Vincent? Bring Gabe Vincent into the action, have him switch onto Kevin Durant and have Kevin Durant either shoot over him or have the help defender come over and then spray out for a three. So I think LA, like, this has been a bit of a blind spot, in my opinion, for the coaching staff defensively. And obviously, they had some nice results for like that 24-game stretch. But before and after that, they were a bottom 10 defense. And I don't think this is the best way to maximize this defensive talent.
No, one quick note in terms of process, because like, let's follow this thought through to conclusion. So let's say we take Gabe off the floor and we put a Marcus Smart out there or Jared Vanderbilt out there. Essentially, what will happen there is the process for the opponent changes, and it will shift towards attacking Luka with a faster player or attacking Austin with a stronger player. And yeah, will Austin hold up a little bit better than Gabe? Well, sure, but the same problem persists. Like, let's say on Friday night, Julius Randle's looking to attack Austin Reeves in space because we've heard that JJ might make starting lineup adjustments opponent to opponent. So, by the way, Jovan, do you have any intel on whether or not Gabe's going to start on Friday?
No not update on point. That yet. So, I mean, I would assume that he probably does, but I think especially against Minnesota and that size, like I don't like him against Gobert. I don't like him against Randle. I don't like him against McDaniels. I don't like him against Ant. So that's a tough one.
To your point, the process will still come down to a defensive game planning piece where let's say that they're attacking Luka with Ant, or they're attacking Austin with Julius, there's going to need to be more planning on the backside. And by the way, when you reference last year, this is what I keep thinking about too. I think it has a little bit more to do with being prepared to get beat in that one-on-one than necessarily like putting yourself in a position where you're not going to get beat. The Lakers just don't have the defensive personnel to throw out five-man units that there's no easy person to attack. It's just not something that they have personnel-wise. And so I think we did see some of this, by the way, in terms of the defensive game plan they used against most guards, where it'd be like, okay, they're attacking off the slot. We're going to funnel towards the sideline. We're going to, they did a lot against Minnesota of like pinching in a little bit off the strong side corner, for example. Like, there are little things you can do. They just need to have a plan, because to your point, there were a lot of Jimmy on Gabe post-ups where there was quite literally no gapping, no back line, no nothing. It was just you're on your own, Gabe. And that is where you're essentially setting yourself up for failure.
So what is what should be the solution then? Should they change their starting five at this point and bring Gabe out of there? And then who takes that spot? Is it Smart? Smart, by the way, does have a 6'9 wingspan. That does allow it. It also helps that he's like a fire hydrant, right? He's impossible to move. So I do agree with you that you got to do something. Jovan, you're on the side of starting Marcus Smart. Jason, is that where you're at as well?
Yeah, smarter Vando would be the two ways that I would go. I know that Vando has been completely putrid on offense to start, but I do think he'll be better. I like there are certain things where like that baseline lob that Luka threw him in the first half where he just like kind of fumbled it and threw up that kind of garbagey reverse layup. Like, I think Vando's capable of finishing a play like that. There was a play where he drove right into Draymond and Jackson Hayes was wide open for a drop off dunk. And he just tried to shoot through Draymond. And it's like, I think Vando's capable of making a play like that. Jovan and I were joking yesterday, like, I think he's capable of hitting, 34, 33% of his threes. And Jovan's like, let's start with 18%. Let's build up from there. But like,
let's start with hitting the rim.
But either way, I think those are fine options. I mean, the other thing too is with Gabe, like, he's effectively your third best ball handler now. So there's a certain amount of like staggering where you kind of need him to be anchoring bench units with ball handling anyway. All I'm saying is that let's not pretend like there was this obvious like option that was clearly the right choice. Like, I think every single one of the four options had clear downsides, including like with Marcus. Like, he looks slow right now and he also can't shoot threes right now. So like, it's there's obvious downsides with every single one of these dudes.
So Let's get into what they need to do here for this next matchup against the Wolves beyond just the starting lineup. What needs to change based on what we saw against the Warriors? And we'll get to that in 30 seconds. Give a shout out to our sponsor here.
Sleeper is the number one fantasy sports app. It pays to know sports. Pick more or less on top players. Your first pick is on us, so start winning now. Play in Texas, Georgia, Minnesota, and 27 more states. Pick anytime across all sports, pregame or live. Over 10 million players are already on Sleeper. Make your picks count. Score up to 1,000 times your cash. Join today. Get up to $100 credit using code HMA. Call your shot on Sleeper. Download now.
All right. Again, use that code HMA over with Sleeper. All right, guys. So tomorrow night, the Lakers take on the Minnesota Timberwolves, the team that knocked them out in five games in the playoffs. How much can they lean upon that series now that they're going into this one without LeBron James? You've got some different personnel. How much can they really look back to that for a starting point for game planning for this next game coming up tomorrow?
This is tricky because Minnesota is like such a different animal in the postseason. Just ask the Lakers last year, who managed to beat Minnesota in the regular season in a way that they weren't able to in the postseason. Ask Phoenix 2 years ago, who went 4-0 against Minnesota in the regular season and then went 0-4 against them in the postseason. Was that 3 years ago now? It's been a while.
Two years ago.
Okay. But anyway, like I think that a lot of the stuff we covered in the first segment is applicable here. Like, we know that Anthony Edwards is going to be targeting slower footed players like Luka in the at the top of the floor. That's where it's going to be a lot of that stuff we talked about earlier, funneling towards the sideline, having your help defense set up, staying home. I think I'd stay home in the strong side corner with Ant and watch that weak side skip, although Jaden McDaniels has kind of shot the ball in a way that is particularly interesting since last year's postseason run. So that's something to keep an eye on. But I think similarly with Julius Randle, being prepared for his mismatch attacking. And then just overall, just I think it's a great second game for the Lakers as a test, because that first game, I thought they got physically kind of outplayed in terms of just their overall competitiveness. And there were stretches in the preseason where I thought the Lakers brought the physicality and intensity. I thought the Dallas game was a classic example of that. They came out and kind of punched Dallas in the mouth. And so that's what I got my eye on tomorrow night. I want to see the Lakers come out and physically rise to the moment competitively and take it to Minnesota, even if they're a little overmatched. And I think we all agree Minnesota should be favored in that game. But like, this is, I'm really interested in seeing the competitive response from this group.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to, like, if I'm JJ, I'm playing some of the highlights or lowlights from that first round series in the locker room as like motivation. Like, I made this point before when the Lakers would play the Nuggets of like, I want to see them come out with a certain extra juice and fire for this matchup. I would like to see that on Friday. And that's like this intangible thing that you can't really quantify. You can just see it with your eyes. And I would like to see a little bit extra from them going up against the Wolves. But I mean, I think a key is going to be gang rebounding, because they're going to be at a size disadvantage, especially if they stick with this starting group. You could argue that Minnesota, especially now, even adding now that Dante DiVincenzo is starting ahead of Mike Conley, they could be at a physical disadvantage at all five starting positions, you could argue, depending on how you view the matchups, right? Like Ayton versus Gobert. Gobert's bigger, he's a better rebounder. Randle versus Rui, McDaniels versus Luka. We saw how that played out in the playoffs. Like, Luka is a really good defensive rebounder, but McDaniels is a bit quicker, longer, taller. Then you got Ant versus Austin and Gabe versus DiVincenzo. Like, Minnesota's, I think, bigger at all five positions. So that's where I think smart. Like, it's more of honestly a Vando matchup, but Vando just played 12 minutes. He was the ninth man. We've seen now in the two serious games that the Lakers have gone with the rotation, he's been the eighth or ninth man. I don't, that tracks with how JJ used him last season. Clearly the shooting and the spacing is enough of an issue for JJ that I don't see Vando all of a sudden playing 20 plus minutes or starting. I think it's more of a Marcus versus Gabe conversation. And again, just with the size, the physicality, and being able to switch across multiple positions, I think Marcus makes far more sense. I also think it balances out the bench a bit because we saw some lineups with this quartet of Jackson, Vando, Jake LaRavia, and Marcus with either Austin or Luca. And it's basically one scorer slash ball handler with the Banshees. That this is the new Banshee group for JJ. I think if you swap Gabe in for Marcus, that brings a little bit more shooting to that group, a little bit more spacing, at least in terms of how people guard Marcus versus Gabe. And it balances out a little bit with another ball handler where like Marcus can do that. But I just think it, Gabe is a little bit more of a, he's more of a laser to use JJ's terminology. So I think that's just like a natural pairing within the rotation. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think the big thing is going to be like the defensive rebounding. Also being, as Jason has pointed out, like but with the help and where you're at, not leaving guys on an island, especially against Julius and Ant. And then offensively, I'd like to see them get into the teeth of the defense more like they did against Golden State. Obviously, it's a different, you're going into the trees there with Gobert and McDaniels and Randall. But I would like to see them, you know, paint touches to kick out passes. Like, I think that's the way they need to function offensively.
As amazing as Luka looked in game one, I'm really curious just to see this because this is the next level challenge for him. Because one of the big things that, I mean, there was a pretty significant difference in how comfortable he looked attacking Minnesota in 2024 in the Western Conference Finals compared to that first round series. Like he was tossing Jaden McDaniels around like a rag doll in the Western Conference Finals. And Jaden was actually making him uncomfortable in that first round series. He had, I think he had more success ISOing Gobert than people gave him credit for in the first round last year, but he was torching him in the 2024 series, both in like drop coverages and help and also in one-on-ones. And so this is like a great, like next, we talked about like next step, next like kind of evaluation of this team. Let's see how Luka does against this Minnesota team. Just in terms of whether or not he's back at that MVP level. And then secondly, let's not forget Austin kind of got his lunch eaten by these guys. So I'm really curious to see if Austin's got something to show us.
Yeah, I wanted to go to that with you guys. Luka, I think you're absolutely right. Luka, this will be a good test of what is the improved conditioning and the weight loss really do for Luka? Because we did see a number of times. Now, he was sick too, but a number of times in the playoffs where he was pretty slow and they were attacking him and there were lots of issues there. So I think this is sort of maybe a bit of a revenge game. You talked about playing with that extra aggressiveness in this one, a revenge game narrative for Luka. I can definitely see Luka being the kind of guy that will take that playoff series personally and come out with a little bit extra for this game. But Austin has been hearing it all summer about he can't play with Luka. He can't defend. He was awful in the playoffs, on and on and on. That's all he's been hearing all summer long. Yova, what are you expecting out of Austin in this game? Is it more of the same, or can he flip the script on that narrative?
I think he can, and I thought, you know, he had an interesting game against the Warriors because statistically you look at 26-9, and on paper that's a really good game, but he led the team in turnovers with 5, 7-10 at the free throw line, and also just 1-for-5 on threes, and I thought those were three areas the Lakers left a lot of points on the board with just far too many turnovers, 9 in the first quarter, 15 in the first half. They missed 11 free throws in a game. They lost by 10 points and they shot 25% on threes, which we've seen it with this group. They will go through some periods where they don't shoot the ball that well, but like, obviously that's an outlier performance. So you look at some of the ways they lost that game, and Austin, I felt, was at the center of it. He also scored several points down the stretch in that pseudo comeback, let's say, that they made in the fourth quarter. So really, if we're looking at like the first 3.5 quarters, his numbers are a little bit different. I think it's closer to like 16, 17 points, 7, 8 assists, which is solid, but not the level that we've come to expect with Austin, especially when one of the star players is out. So as far as the Minnesota matchup, like, it's interesting because statistically he defended Ant the best out of any Lakers perimeter defender last year. If you look at the NBA.com tracking data, like in terms of the high volume guys who are matched up with Ant, he defended him better than Rui and better than Gabe and like whoever else you're throwing in there, better than Luka. Like, Austin actually held his own to an extent against Anthony Edwards, but overall really struggled with the catch and shoot, really struggled with their ball pressure and making decisions and quick reads and in the pick and roll and in isolation. And so I think that's the next level test for Austin, is like, this is the team that they're three front court guys are 6'9" and bigger. They could put Jaden McDaniels, Ant on him, DiVincenzo. They got a young, athletic team that plays with a certain tenacity. So this is the type of team that gives Austin problems. We saw it in the first round. And I think he's been in a pretty good space to start the season, especially the first three preseason games. He was crushing it in isolation, in pick and roll reads, scoring, getting to his mid-range bag. I think he did that to an extent against Golden State, but like this is the next level. So I don't know how he's going to perform, but I think based on how he's looked so far, I'm slightly more bullish than maybe I was a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, there's so many things with Austin that you can kind of like see the reason why we've loved him as fans of his over the course of the last few years, but the obvious limitations that have popped up at various points. Like, you want to know how he ends up with 26-9? Because he's a competitive MF-er that was not about to try to have that game end the way that it ended, and he just kept attacking and attacking and attacking, and he found a little rhythm late. And when he did, he was able to push the game at least reasonably into to a spot where you could a couple plays go differently and the Lakers have a shot to win it late, right? But throughout the game, when he struggled for the most part, it was a lot of the same stuff that we've seen over the years. I'm glad Jovan mentioned the ball pressure. There was a tendency that I saw in the Golden State game and also that showed up in the Minnesota game where he tends to retreat against pressure and he gets caught in some really difficult positions out near half court where he's like picking up his dribble and having to make some pretty difficult passes against pressure across long distances because he gets himself into some tough spots out by half court. In the early third quarter run, there was a play where he drew basically a blitz way out at half court. And he threw a pass, just rushed it, just kind of panicked and threw a pocket pass right in front of Ayton as he was slipping out of the screen. And you can just tell he's just a little uncomfortable, a little spooked by that pressure when it pushes him way out to half court. And so obviously that's an area of improvement. And then I believe he's 6-for-27 on threes, counting preseason and in the Tuesday night game. That's, you know, kind of disappointing because I think that was the obvious area of improvement that I needed to show before the season, and it just hasn't shown up yet. The one little caveat I'd say there, though, is there's always, in my opinion, a difficulty going from working on something in individual workouts, translating it to practice, and then translating it to games. I think Jared Vanderbilt's dealing with something similar. Like, you work on your form and you make that release a little bit more crisp and fluid, and that's great. But it's different when it's in a workout, and then it's different when you're playing 5-on-5 in the practice arena, and it's different when you're doing it in front of 20,000 people. And I think there's a little bit of like a transition phase for each of those things. And so I know Austin, we talked about his competitiveness. I know Austin worked on that 3-point shot all summer. So it's more just that it hasn't shown up yet. But I think if that comes around, I think that's a key piece. Jovan, you appropriately pointed out earlier, he has been shooting the ball well from 2-point range, and he was lethal from there in preseason. So there's still a lot of upside there, but just handling the ball pressure a little bit better and then obviously knocking down that 3-point shot. I think that's like the next level for Austin to become an all-star level player.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, Austin, when you look at that game against the Warriors, he had 5 turnovers. 4 of them were live ball turnovers. Those are especially damaging. It's important that we differentiate between live ball and dead ball turnovers. The Lakers, I thought, were actually a little bit lucky that 10 live ball turnovers, way too many, obviously, but only gave up 10 points on those live ball turnovers. Typically, you'll see that number even higher. So they were perhaps a little bit fortunate, but Austin's got to be better handling the ball, got to be better with his decision-making, not just when LeBron is out, but also when we're projecting forward for the future. With him as a ball handler when Luka is not on the floor, and perhaps in a post-LeBron world as well. Austin's got to make sure that he's taking care of that basketball. Now, as far as the shooting goes, I think that will come back around. It's not always a sticky stat. There can be, you know, game to game, month to month. We remember Kentavious Caldwell-Pope used to go cold for months at a time, and then he'd just be on a heater from then on. You never know with shooting. It can be a little bit up and down, but I think that Austin's three-point shooting will come back around. If it can happen this game, obviously that would be a great thing to see. Jovan, you did call out the scoring in the paint, though, as a positive. I know we've talked a lot about stuff they need to fix and some negatives. Luka and Austin both extremely efficient in the paint. Can that continue against going from a team that started small with Draymond, who's a phenomenal paint defender, but started small? Can they continue that kind of paint production when now you're going up against Rudy Gobert sitting in the middle?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the efficiency of shooting 18 for 20 in the paint is not going to continue against the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Hot take.
I think if they get up 20, 25 shots in the paint, I will be happy with that. Right. Like I think that just that would be progress from last season. Cause I think a big thing from that series, like in thinking how Minnesota is going to try to defend them, was that they threw a curveball at the Lakers in game one that I was kind of surprised JJ admitted to after the game, where Lakers thought they were going to play coverage, and going back and looking at the Western Conference Finals between Dallas and Minnesota, Luka just cooked them in drop coverage, and then eventually they started to switch more throughout that series. But it seemed to be more of a playoff adjustment rather than, although, you know, obviously they're in the playoffs again, but like it seemed to be like more of a desperation of like, Luka's just killing us, we have to go to do this. They started the series and basically were fine with switching Gobert, Naz Reid, and Julius Randle onto Luka, onto mm-hmm. Austin, onto LeBron, and daring them to beat them off the dribble, or just settle for a step back, pull up jumper of some kind. And based on where Luka was at then compared to where Luka is at now, I have far more confidence in this version of Luka being able to beat those switches and get into the paint and get the Timberwolves defense into rotation and start the blender that way. So I think I think for a lot of that playoff series, he would settle for the step back, and he is so proficient at it that like I get the process with that to an extent. But I think this version of Luka, going back to even Eurobasket, like the biggest thing, I did a film breakdown on it, the biggest change in his game, in my opinion, was his ability to split pick and roll coverages, to get by his man, to get into the paint. And he was finishing at such a high level at the rim and from the mid range that I think that translated in game one, obviously at an insane rate, right? He went 13 for 15 on two pointers against the Warriors. And it's not going to be what he does every single night, but he did look far more comfortable in the middle of the floor, in the mid range and inside the arc compared to last season, where I thought he relied a lot on just his proficient step back game. So I think if he could do that and torch those guys one-on-one, then that opens up so many things for the Lakers offense, because that's when now you have to make a decision of, are we going to start blitzing him? And then that's where hopefully the Lakers are in some better 4-on-3 and 3-on-2 situations.
All right, Before I go here, do you guys...
Oh, go ahead.
Do you guys agree that that Luka looks demonstrably better than he ever did at any point last year? To me, it looks like a completely different player.
I think he definitely looks much better. There were games where he looked really good last season, but I think he's moving a lot better. I've noticed specifically the closeouts. To me, this is anecdotal, but the closeouts to me look a lot quicker when he's getting out to the ball defensively. And I think offensively, you could just see there's more fluidity to his movements. He's getting into the lane a bit easier. Again, we're expecting to see that kind of stuff because of the weight loss. But I like what we've seen out of Luka so far. Again, I don't want to say this is the best version of Luka we've ever seen, but I think this is the better version of Luka compared to what we saw last year for the Lakers.
So he would have games last year where like he'd hit his step back three,
yeah,
and he would pass the ball as well as he always does, and he would put up a monster stat line and look very good. To me, the ability to get to his spots and get separation from good defenders is like completely different. And that's really the big one that stands out to me. Like even just with the short range scoring, I never even thought he was getting like the little bump off separation last year that he was getting in that first game. And so that's what's got me specifically excited. And like, and to the point of the topic, like the part that if you're looking for something as a Lakers fan to be optimistic about relative to the rest of the field, because like there's certain things that the Lakers are just not going to be as good at. They're not as athletic. They are not the type of team that's going to get up in your jersey and make you uncomfortable all game long. There's clear deficits there. But I would argue you're not going to find a trio of players in the league that's better at this short range, kind of like reliable late game scoring than this group, because you've got Luka, who's one of the very best in the league at it. You've got Austin, who's one of the very best in the league at it. And LeBron's a dude that you throw the ball down to him in the post against a decent mismatch, he's going to get a decent look right at the rim or a kick out for a high percentage shot. And so they have like a lot of options in this like short mid-range scoring that a lot of teams in the league don't have. And I would argue that that is the most reliable form of late game scoring that exists in the league, because shooting always involves variance, and the defensive intensity at the end of games is so good at taking away the rim and so good at closing out to shooters for most good teams in the league that you typically need a guy that can create his own shot at a kind of a more efficient rate than a three-point shot. And the Lakers just have three dudes who can do that. And I think that's a huge upside. And like, to your point, that's literally the biggest silver lining from that first night, is like, you, just Luka and Austin look surgical in that short to mid range.
So are we going to see less, as the fans would say, fake comebacks this season then, if the Lakers do have that late game scoring ability?
I was joking with Jovan about that yesterday. It's classic. We're used to it at this point.
I mean, they were a pretty good crunch time team last year.
Yeah.
They won a lot of close games.
The thing is, I think everybody expects, when your team starts coming back, you expect them to complete that process and win the game. And so anytime they don't, it stands out and it stings. It hurts. And so people remember that. But I want to go back to something Jovan said. You were talking about Luka being able to beat those switches, if it's Naz Reid switched onto him or Julius Randle, whoever winds up, Gobert, being able to really punish the Wolves for those situations rather than allowing them to live with that. And then talking about perhaps blitzing, trying to get the ball out of Luka's hands, and then getting into those 4-on-3 situations. Oftentimes it's a DeAndre Ayton, sometimes it's a Jackson Hayes, someone like that that's being put into the position where they're catching the ball around the free throw line, sometimes up a little bit higher, and then having to make those decisions in that 4-on-3. How comfortable are you right now with that specific situation? Because I think you're right, that would be the adjustment from the Wolves. Can the Lakers capitalize on that?
I'm like fairly comfortable with it. I think when it's a simple and clear read, DeAndre Ayton makes it, like, I think he showed in the preseason, he averaged almost 3 assists per 36 minutes, which would be a career high for him. I think, like, there was some playmaking there, right? And we've seen a little bit of that in the short role. I think with Golden State, that was a particularly tough matchup for him because there's, like, this controlled chaos element to their defense and their ability to just scramble and rotate and just wreak havoc against indecision, right? And the Lakers had a lot of indecision with the role players. There's just the extra half second to full second of trying to read the defense and process that, I think with Ayton, with Rui, and with a couple of the other guys, that's just death against the Warriors defense. With Minnesota, I think they rely a little bit more on their length and their collective size, though they are an aggressive defense as well. But they have a little bit more margin for error with just the collective, like Gobert is taking up the entire paint when he stretches his arms out. So that is a little bit of a different element there. But I think, especially if it is, let's say, McDaniels and Gobert as the two guys blitzing and trapping Luka, and now it's DeAndre Ayton slipping out of there and getting the short roll pass. I guess you still have Ant back there. You still have Rand. Like, yeah, you still have some big athletic players, but I think the Lakers have to figure out their spacing on those situations as well. I think there were times where guys just weren't in the right spots or were trying to relocate to the right spot, but they were a beat too late. So I think right now, like, I'm fairly comfortable with it. We did see him do it a bit in the preseason, but I would not say it's a strength of his for his career. He's under 2 assists per game. I wouldn't say he's like a high level passer, even by like center standards. I think it's something that he needs to continue to work on, and that you just need like more live game reps, right? And being in more 4-on-3, 3-on-2 situations. So this will be another big test for him and his decision making and his playmaking. I have more concern with him, honestly, in traffic, where I think he brings the ball down too low, gets stripped continually. And like, that's something he needs to stop doing. But in those, like, if he's around the elbow or you kind of just free throw line area, I think he can make some of those reads.
Yeah, you know, I think Jovan broke it down really well. I think the interior stuff in terms of his struggles dealing with like traffic and people swarming him right under the basket are kind of gonna just be what Ayton's like. Also, I mean, the little post turnarounds, like the little right shoulder fades and the left shoulder hooks and stuff that he takes, that's never been anything he's been particularly good at. Ironically, in the percentages, he's really solid popping to that elbow area and knocking down like short roll jump shots when he's like facing the rim. But anytime he has to turn over his shoulders over the top of like a guy closer to the basket, those are shots that I haven't really liked for Ayton in his career. Those are things that I kind of expect to more or less remain the same over the course of his time here. I 100% agree with Jovan that like the reps are going to be the key with the reads. Because one of the things that happens with Luka is he just creates super easy reads. And the example I'll give is in the second half run, early in that run when the Warriors took control of the game, there was a play where Luka drew a blitz and he hits Ayton on the roll. And Ayton catches in the middle of the floor, and Steph is tagging really hard off of Gabe on the right wing. And Gabe is wide open, and that's the correct read. Rui is in the right corner, and he's more or less guarded. There's an easier closeout there. And Ayton just misses the read, and instead of throwing it to Gabe for what would have been a wide-open catch-and-shoot three, he throws it to the corner instead. Rui then rotates it up to Gabe, but that extra pass buys Steph that extra second to close out. Now Gabe is shooting a rushed shot, and you could see Gabe actually shot it higher than he typically does, and he misses the shot. And so it's like a really easy read to a clear open shooter on the right wing that Ayton just missed, because it's a lot more open than the types of reads he was getting in Portland. And this is just going to be one of those things where I'm more optimistic about him getting that stuff down. I'm more optimistic about the lobs, the lob timing. Like a lot of this is Austin and Luka's fault too. Like I've seen Luka throw a couple really bad lobs to Ayton in preseason games where I'm like, that's unusual. Like it's a rifle pass. It's not timed super well. Some of it's Ayton as well. And some of the timing on his rolls and that kind of stuff, the lobs, the reads, I'm a little bit more optimistic about. I just think Laker fans need to be accustomed to him kind of making some questionable decisions when he catches right under the basket for tough turnarounds and, like Jovan said, getting stripped down low.
Do you guys feel like they're trying to force the lobs a little bit to Ayton?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's one of those things where in order for anything to work, the counter has to be sold properly. So like if Luka keeps hitting these little short shots like he's been hitting, eventually the big will really start overreacting to him on those like kind of deeper penetrations along the lane line. All of a sudden those lobs are going to be wide open, especially if we start hitting that corner skip to Rui. It's going to turn into the classic decision you've got to make. Are you going to tag the roller? Or are you going to stay home on Rui? Mm-hmm. And I think those are the kinds of like sequences and timing that they're going to get really good at as time goes on. And by the way, their pick and roll efficiency was awesome in that game. I think they were well up over 110 offensive rating in pick and rolls, including passes, according to Synergy. And again, in half court situations, that's really efficient. And that was with a lot of mistakes and a lot of botched lobs and botched shots. So, I mean, I'm optimistic there.
I had Eddie Johnson, who does commentary for the Suns, tell me yesterday, said, that DeAndre Ayton has, and I'm quoting him here, itty bitty baby hands, and that he cannot palm a basketball, and that's why he loses the ball so much in the paint. Where are you at? Because that has been my biggest pet peeve with Ayton, has been bringing the ball down in traffic. Does he have itty bitty baby hands, and is that the problem, or is there, can there be growth in that area when we're looking at it? I believe he had four turnovers against the Warriors.
Well, my favorite Ayton stat going into the season was that he has more turnovers than assists for his career. Mm-hmm. And every season he has averaged at least as many turnovers as assists. So he's never had a season where he's averaged more assists than turnovers. And even going back to the preseason, I mentioned the 2.7 assists per 36 minutes. That would be a career high if that were to extend into the regular season. He also averaged 2.7 turnovers, which would be a career high for him. So even in the preseason, he was averaging as many assists as turnovers. So this is just part of the Ayton experience. I think you get taught when you're in like middle school that You know, I was always a power forward or center. And it was like you grab a rebound, and especially if it's like an offensive rebound, you keep the ball up here. You do not bring it below you don't even mm-hmm. really want to bring it to your chest necessarily, but you don't want to bring it below your chest. And that's what he does, especially on offensive rebounds. I think it's an issue where he'll grab, he'll muscle his way, get in there, grab an offensive rebound, and he just brings the ball down, and all of a sudden guards start to swipe at it. And I think like the jury's out a little bit with him, where I've noticed, I feel like it's on the scouting report, where you will see guys cheat off, especially on the weak side. When they see Ayton's about to catch a pass, that guard will try to shoot the gap and immediately come from behind and try to swipe at it because they know he's probably bringing the ball down. So it's something that he needs to work on at this stage of his career. I feel like he's done this enough, and this is just like part of who he is, that he can maybe be like more selective with it and do it like a little bit less. But I just feel like this is part of the Ayton experience.
Yeah. One of the big things that's always stood out to me with him, even before he was a Laker, but has obviously been kind of a hallmark of his first impression with the team. He just kind of lacks intensity. It's hard to explain. Like everything he's doing is just a little bit chill. Like he's always a little upright. Like when he's moving around on defense, he's not super low in his stance mm-hmm. and like athletically moving around. He's kind of just upright and relaxed on his rolls. It always feels like it's not like he's catching and quickly turning and looking to make a read. It's always just like everything's just happening a little bit slow motion, which is a testament to his talent because he's still a pretty good player despite the fact that he plays with very little intensity. But I think that's been the thing too. Like I think when he catches on the roll, it's got to be really the order of operations has to be quick. Get the ball high quick. Get your head turned around to the weak side quick. Everything just needs to happen a second faster. And I think I'm optimistic that this season, if there was an opportunity for him to, let's say, average 3.5 assists per 36 and 2.5 turnovers per 36. So to Jovan's point, the first season where he's a net positive assist to turnover guy, this would be the opportunity because he's going to be surrounded by more skill and with a better advantage creator than he's ever played with. I just think it's more likely to trend that way over the course of the season and start a little bit more on the sloppy end as he's figuring it out. But, you know, this is the other thing too. He hasn't really had a ton of repetition with Luka yet. And so he's kind of learning on the fly here within the season. And I think he'll get some good opportunities here as the season progresses.
All right, guys, let's close out the show here with some predictions. So tomorrow's game, I just looked, and right now the Wolves are a 1.5 favorite home game for the Lakers. Do they get their revenge for the playoffs? How do you see this game playing out? Jovan, let's start with you.
I think Minnesota wins. I'm sorry to
all of
the Laker fans watching right now. I'm being honest here. But I think it's a close game, and I think they get revenge. I think it's a better showing overall than the Golden State game because I felt Golden State was in control of that game for basically from the middle of the first quarter on. And Lakers did have the run to close the second quarter. They had the run in the middle of the fourth quarter. They did have some nice stretches, but overall, I felt just like eye test wise and even just from the lead, like Golden State was pretty much in control of that game from minute six on. This one, I think, will be more of a true back and forth that will go into the fourth quarter and will be a game that goes into crunch time and is about execution. And at this stage, I think a fully healthy or close to fully healthy Minnesota team, I have more confidence in than a Lakers team without LeBron. Like we can't undersell how important LeBron is and how all this roster was built with LeBron and Luka in mind together, right? And so you take out the second best player on the team, a top 15 at worst player in the league. That's a big blow for this team. And I thought like you could look at things a couple of ways from the first game. Like Luka was awesome and he looks like, to Jason's point, arguably the second best player in the world. But they also really missed LeBron, and you saw a little bit of a deficit there with the ball handling, the playmaking, the shot creation, like outside of Luka and Austin. The drop off to a Gabe or to a Marcus is substantial, even to a point of like it was glaring. So I think they really miss LeBron. So if LeBron was, I'll have the caveat here of if LeBron was playing, I would pick the Lakers to win this game. Without LeBron, I think they lose a close game.
I'm glad you mentioned LeBron because, like, one of the ways that the Lakers had kind of dominated the Warriors matchup over the previous seasons was Anthony Davis and obviously his ability to roam along the back line. But it was also LeBron. LeBron was also one of the dudes who was really good at trolling the back line of the Golden State offensive attack, you know, tracking back cutters and helping guys communicate through switches. And I think just missing him as a defensive communicator and backline guy, I think, was huge. And that goes that's only on one side of the floor. As far as the Minnesota game goes, Minnesota's obviously the better team, but I kind of view it as more of a coin flip, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Lakers got a win tonight. And the main reason why is because, again, Minnesota can ebb and flow in their physical intensity in the regular season. They're coming off of a win, whereas the Lakers are coming off of more or less of an embarrassing loss. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Lakers came out a little bit more competitively engaged than Minnesota did. And let's not forget that Petty Luka exists, and Petty, like Luka got outplayed by Ant last year in the first round, especially in fourth quarters. Like, Ant just walked him down in every fourth quarter, and Luka was essentially a non-factor in every fourth quarter that he played in that series. And so I'm sure Luka would love the opportunity to just kind of send a little message to Ant and to everybody else watching that he's the better basketball player, which I believe he is. So, like, there's a certain amount of, like, if the Lakers come out with a good physical intensity at home, crowd engaged, role players play a little bit better, and Luka really tries to put his thumb on the scale as the second or third best player in the world, I think there's a version of this game where the Lakers can win. But that goes with the caveat of obviously acknowledging that Minnesota without LeBron is a better basketball team.
Yeah, I think ultimately, as much
we need a prediction from you, Jason.
Right.
I'll go Lakers win a close game.
Okay. So Jovan is the hater and says Lakers are going to lose. Jason's the optimist and Lakers are going to win. I hate it. My purple and gold heart wants to say the Lakers are going to win, but I have a hard time seeing. I'm more side. It hurts to do it, but I'm more side with Jovan here that I think I'm actually surprised Wolves aren't a heavier favorite than a point and a half when I look at this, just because. Go ahead.
Or sorry, no, I finish your point and then I was going to say,
in part because of the stuff you guys have mentioned about no LeBron, you guys hit most of the points already. And I do wonder how the Lakers are going to match up physically in this game, because the Wolves have so many advantages out there. I think that's going to be a little bit overwhelming. I'm also, like, getting a little bit concerned that this third quarter thing, like, might be really something here in their heads. I mean, how many points do they need to lead by going into a third quarter to exit the quarter with the lead? I think that could be a problem in this one too. If they do wind up getting run off the floor in the third quarter again, obviously, that's going to be a challenge for the fourth. But also, I echo the other sentiments that you made there, Jovan. What did you have that you wanted to throw in?
So the caveat I wanted to add, that I'm a big caveat guy, clearly. hearing Jason's point, I think for me, one thing that would potentially swing this for me in favor of the Lakers winning a close game or just winning the game at all would be a dramatic change to the rotation. I personally do not like the opening rotation we've seen the first two games against the Kings and in the preseason finale and then against the Warriors. So if JJ changes the starting group and changes some of the bench lineups, I think that puts them in a position to have a better shot to win this game. But right now, I think, at least from what we've seen from JJ going back to last season in the playoffs to some degree, and even just to start the season, I feel like he wants to test out this rotation in some of these lineups and, like, at least have a little bit more of a sample size. I'm a bit skeptical of that sample size. So I'm operating under the assumption that they're probably going with a pretty similar rotation up to this point. And with that context, like, I feel like that's where I think this is probably a loss. If they surprise us and maybe Marcus Smart or they're changing things up with the bench groups. Cause, like, I think if you're throwing out this Jackson, Vando, Laravia, Smart, Austin lineup, like, I really just don't like that lineup. I don't think that is a lineup that should be playing against good teams. So maybe JJ surprises us and has a curveball of, like, a dramatically different starting or overall rotation. If it's the same one, I personally don't like it right now.
Thought there on that, just really quickly. Mm-hmm. I'm glad Jovan pointed out this lineup. I don't think you can play. This is why I look at Vando as a potential starter, but I would agree with Jovan's point about that particular lineup. I don't think you can play two non-shooters unless Luka's on the floor. He's the one guy who is offensively capable of carrying that type of flawed offensive lineup. When you start putting Austin out there with Vando and Jackson at the same time, I think that's a recipe for disaster. Just Austin's not the type of player that's going to be able to lift that type of flawed construct.
Which then can give you some issues on the defensive side when you do make sure that you've got enough out there. That's been the challenge for the Lakers for years now, has been too many guys that are one side of the ball or the other or not both. And that's been an issue for them. And obviously that gets involved with Jared Vanderbilt and the whole conversation with him and that lineup in general. We're talking about Laravia and Vando and Hayes. And all, I mean, it's got good size. Okay. You know, and you could be a little bit switchy defensively with that lineup. But in terms of the offensive production, I just look at the defense that the Wolves have. I think, man, they're gonna eat that alive, and maybe pun intended there with the Wolves. But I do want to say I hope I'm wrong in that prediction, and I hope the Lakers can find a way to get the win there. But guys, this was awesome. The great debut episode. Appreciate everybody who joined us live. Jovan, Jason, this is, I'm so excited that we get to do this. Three of us get to sit down and talk Lakers every single week, and I appreciate you guys for making this happen.
I had a ton of fun, man. I'm really looking forward to doing this every week.
This is awesome.
Everybody watching us, if you have not done so yet, make sure you hit the subscribe button over on the Lakers Collective. We will be back next week. Thank you, everybody. Till then, see ya and stay safe.